Okay, we start here from the two dots on the bottom of Samach Amud Bet. Here, the Gemara is continuing with the Agadato with regards to Kitetze Eish Umatzah Kutzim, dealing with the issues of Eish. And it says here, Vitaveh David, Vayomer, Mi Ashkeni Mayim Mibor Beit Lechem Asher Bashar. Who can go and get me water to drink from the cistern that is in the entrance to Beit Lechem? Vayivaku Shlosha Giborim, Shloshet Agiborim B'machane Plishtim, Vayishavu Mayim Mibor Beit Lechem Asher Bashar. The three of the warriors were able to break through the Machane Plishtim, the camp of the Plishtim, and they were able to draw water from the Bor Beit Lechem Asher Bashar. Makami Bayile, what exactly was the issue? So the Gemara over here assumes because of the fact that it was Asher Bashar, which seems to be extraneous in nature, that the Shar refers to the Sanhedrin, or the Zikne Ashar, that's the way they're referred to in Sefer Dvarim, that the Sanhedrin or the Zikenim sit in the Shar. So the assumption of the Gemara is that David had some sort of halachic question, and he wanted someone to get the Mayim, which is Torah Nimshalada Mayim, Torah is like water. So he had a shiloh, he had a question that needed to be asked. He was in the middle of the battle, middle of the war, and he needed someone to ask the question. So these three Giborim risked their lives, break through the Machane Plishtim to get to wherever the Sanhedrin was, and to ask the Mayim, ask the question of the Sanhedrin, and bring back the answer to David. So the Gemara now wants to know, Makami Baile, what exactly was this pressing question that he had to ask? So Amar Rav Nachman, Tamun Beish Kami Baile. He's asking a question about Tamun Beish, Iker Rav Yehuda, Iker Rabbanan. Machloket Rav Yehuda and Rabbanan, as to whether by Eish you are Chayav by Tamun, which is the sheet of Rav Yehuda, which we've seen already, or like the Chachamim, who say that you are Patur by Tamun Beish. Upashtule Mad Pashtule. Gemara says, then they answered him what they answered him. They don't give the answer about who the halacha is like, but they simply say they give him the answer, whatever it was. Obviously, if they knew what the answer was, then there wouldn't be any shaylas had to paskin over here. But they gave him the answer that he wanted. Rashi claims that the case was over here. Maseh balefanav machaneh shesarfu anshav gadish shel Yisrael. In his encampment, there were soldiers that burnt down a pile of grain. Did they have to pay for the items that were hidden inside of the Gadish, or did they only have to compensate for the Gadish itself? That's the way that Rashi phrases the question. We'll see later on. I'll point out to you that the Balei Tosafot say that Rashi's explanation is difficult based on the end of the Gemara. Rav Huna Amar, Gidishim disa'urim disrael havu, dava mitamrei plishtim behu. There were these piles of se'urim that belonged to the Jews, but the Plishtim were hiding out in them. Question here was, do you have a right to save yourself through the money of your friend, through the possessions of your friend? They could burn down the Gdishim. That would force the Plishtim to run away or force the Plishtim to be exposed. But it would be at the cost of the other people's property. Are you allowed to do this to other people's property? They said back to him, Asur latzilatzmo b'mon chaveiro. It is not permitted to save oneself through the possessions of his friend. Aval ata melechata, you are a king. Umelech poritz lasot lo derech veim ochin biyado. A king has a right to break through, to do what he likes, basically to exert eminent domain. And therefore you as the king have a right to do this, even though regular commoners would not have a right to do this. The nature of the question is somewhat uncertain here. Rashi claims that the question is a question lechatchila, which is, are you allowed to really save your life with your friend's possessions? The Balei Tosafot, on the other hand, say over here, Yibayle yichayav l'shalem kashi yitzila atzmo mipnei pikuach nefesh. The Balei Tosafot take it as a given that you can save yourself with your friend's possessions because it's a life issue. Life issues, of course, you're allowed to do whatever it takes to save your life. The only question is, are you then responsible to pay for it or to compensate? Do we say because it's pikuach nefesh, therefore you're granted the right to do this and do not have to compensate? Or do we say, okay, you're granted the right to do this, but you still then have to pay back your friend? So the Balei Tosafot see this as a bidyavad question, which is, once you've already been permitted to save yourself because of pikuach nefesh, do you have to compensate or not? For Rashi, it seems like the question is more the chatchilo, which is, are you allowed to save your life with your friend's money. And through the poskim and through the halacha, the same difference or question arises, whether there is permission to use your friend's possessions to save your life. Seemingly, and most likely, if it's for bikuach nefesh, the answer would be yes. But if it's to save your own possessions, even if it's much larger amount, or to save a bigger possession or a larger amount of money, there it's very unclear, and probably the answer is no, that you may not use your friend's property in order to save your life. But then again, here the question about compensating or not compensating. Gemara says that for a commoner it would not be allowed. According to the Baya Tosafot, that means you would have to compensate. According to the Rashi, that would mean that you wouldn't be able to do it even lechatchila. But you as a king can exert eminent domain over here. From the Rambam, it sounds like that this right of the king to exert this eminent domain is only in wartime or in a situation of war, not a general heter for the king. Then the last option as to what the question is, Rabbonan. V'item Rabba Bar Mari Amru, G'dishim disorim disrael havu, U'gdishim d'adashim d'plishtim. They had piles of grain of barley that belonged to Jews, and then there were piles of lentils that belonged to the plishtim. V'kam yibaylahu, and this was David's question, Malu to'o g'dishim shel se'orim disrael, Yitain lifnei behem to'o, Amnat l'shalim g'dishim shel adashim d'plishtim. Is he allowed to use the Jewish grains to feed his army or to feed his animals and to utilize them now, again exerting eminent domain, but with the intent to replace it with the lentils or piles of lentils that belong to the plishtim? So there are seemingly two problems here. One is that he doesn't have the piles of the plishtim's lentils yet, because he has yet to conquer them or to succeed or be victorious in the battle. So there's an assumption in the future he will have them to pay it back. The other issue here is why the nature of the question is because of the fact that it's adashim versus se'orim. So the se'orim, which are not so chashuv, and the adashim, which are much more chashuv over here, so then can he replace it? He's giving them actually better items back in return. So maybe that should overcome the issue of, we'll call it gzeila, or overcome the issue of confiscating the Jew's property to use for his army. Does that overcome by the fact that, first of all, he's going to pay it back, and number two, he's going to give them something of even better quality? Shalchulei, so they said back to him, Chavol Yashiv Rasha Gezela Yishalem. So Chavol Yashiv, when someone does damage, he has to replace it, he has to return it. Rasha Gezela Yishalem. And when one steals, they pay for it. But in the end, he's still called a Rasha. Afo Pish Gezela Mishalem Rashahu. Even though you repay that which you've stolen, the name Rasha still applies. So based on that, the Rosh concludes over here that had they had the Adashim in hand, and they had exchanged the Adashim for the Se'orim, even unbeknownst to the owners, that would have been fine. Because first of all, it's an upgrade. And second of all, they're repaying them immediately, and it would not be called a Rasha. On the other hand, the Yamshel Shlomo over here disagrees and says that doesn't make sense. Just because you're upgrading something for an individual doesn't mean you have a right to take their property. You can't be a chamsan and just grab people's property and then pay them back or pay them for it. That is unacceptable. So even if they had the adashim in hand, and even though it was an upgrade, they would not be allowed to do this. The Ksot HaChoshen, in defense of the Rosh, notes that maybe there's a difference between Hamas and the case here. In the case of Hamas, where the person is present and doesn't want to sell it, and nevertheless, you compel them to sell it, even though you're paying them, that's called Hamas. On the other hand, here, where it's unbeknownst to the owner that you're doing this, then we say, or we invoke the principle of Zachin Shaladam Shalom Bifanav, that we allow you to do something to the merit or the benefit of an individual when he's not around. And since he's not around here to object, we assume that most people would want the upgrade from barley to lentils. Unless we know otherwise, we would assume that it is permitted to do so because of the fact, or because of the principle of Zachin Shaladam Shalom Bifanav. Aval again here, Ata Melech, Ata Upmelech Poreitz Lasodu Derech Ven Mochin Biado. You as the king have a right through eminent domain to act in this way. You have special permission. For a commoner, for anyone else, the answer would be no. For you as the king, who's not acting out of personal interest here, but acting out of interest of the tzibor bichlal, or for the am as a whole, in that case, it overrides the personal property rights of individuals, and the king can do this because of his right as the king, or as the leader of the people. So Bishlaman the man damar lechlufei, according to the last version of what the question was, the Rabbanan itema Rabba bar Mari, then we understand Hainu dichtiv chadkra. There's found one pasuk in Shmuel Bet and one pasuk in Divrei Yamim, and there's a slight difference between them. But isham chalkata sadeh mleya adashim. Uchtiv chadkra v'ti chalkata sadeh mleya seorim. So you have an identical pasuk. One of them says that there were piles of seorim there. The other one says that there were piles of adashim there. So according to the one with the question revolved around the switching, meaning the exchanging of the Yisrael's property that he's going to confiscate now, and we being replace it with the Plishtim's property afterwards, that's why there's a change in the type of piles that are here. Alamanda amar lemikle, according to the one whose question was, can we burn them down? Mayibailuhu lahani treikrai. What do I need two psukim for? What's the difference in Sorim and Adashim? Amalacha adamu nami gdishim da Adashim di Israel. Tavu mitamre behu Plishtim. He says, because there were also people hiding in these piles of Seorim and piles of Adashim. Bishlamal namar mikle, the one who asks, says that the question is about can he burn them down in order to rid them of the Plishtim that were hiding there. Hainu dichtiv, vayitiatze betocha chelka, vayatzila. So he stood in the middle of the field, or middle of this property, and he saved it. Meaning, he didn't burn them down. He accepted the psak of the Chachamim, he accepted the psak of the Sanhedrin, that it was improper to do this, even though he as a king had a right to do it. We'll see in a second he does not exercise that right. But nevertheless, Vatzilah, he listens and he saved it. He didn't burn it down. According to one who says that he exchanged it, he was asking, can they replace the Seorim with the Adashim? My Vayatzilah. What does it mean that he saved it? He says, Lo Shaviklu Lachlufe. That's exactly what it means. He didn't let them exchange it. He saved them and he kept their original property there and didn't allow them to exchange it. Bishlama Hane Tarte, according to these latter two explanations as to what happened over here, Hainu Dichtiv Trei Krai, that's why there are two psukim written. Elamanda Amar Tamun Beish Kamibayile, according to the original explanation that the whole question revolved around whether the lacha is like Rabbi Yehuda the Chachamim about Tamun Beish, Mai Ibayile Krai. That's the Girs of Rashi. The Girs of Rashi is, what do you need these psukim at all? This is a basic halachic question. The psukim don't contribute anything at all. Whereas according to the Tosafot, he says that there was a Girsa, which you can clearly see that Rashi is saying that they don't keep that Girsa. He says, Velo Garsin and Trey. Rashi says, don't put the Girsa of Trey in. Whereas the Baalei Tosafot have that Girsa of Tarte Krai Lomali. Why do you need both psukim? And the Tosafot explains that we need one pasuk, at least to tell us what the issue was, that he saved, or that he didn't allow them to burn it down. Either because, according to Rabbi Yehuda, they would be chayav for that which was inside of it, or according to the Chachamim, then they wouldn't have to pay for that which was inside of it. So then, that's the nature of the question. Rashi thinks that you don't need either pasuk here, but the Tosafot say you need one pasuk at least to describe what was happening, or talking about Sreifa, to give you some sense of what the context is, but you don't need both psukim because they're not additive in any way. The Gemara says, Amar lecha tamun v'chad mehanach kam mibayle. Now, according to the one who says he asked about tamun plus one of the other questions. One of the other two questions. Bishlam alaman damar hane tarte hanu dichtiv v'lo ava David lishtotam. So according to whichever of the latter two versions you give, we understand why David refused to drink them. Amar, kevin deika isura, lo nechali. Since for a commoner it would be improper, lo nechali. I didn't want to do this. So even though he as a king had permission to do this, and he could have exercised eminent domain, but since the halacha for a commoner was this way, which means there is an isur for it, but the isur is being waived for him as a king, he refused to accept it and didn't do it, even though technically as a king he could have done it. Elamanda amar tamun beish kami baile. According to the one who says that the question revolved around Tamun Beish, Michte Gmaru de Shalchule, they sent him an answer, My lo avad David ishtotam. What does it mean that David refused to drink them? Or lo avad ishtotam, he didn't want to drink them. The answer is a halachic answer. It's not a question of isur or heter. It's not a question of yes or no. It's simply a question of, is the halacha this way or is the halacha that way? So then, what does that mean? That, delo aminu mishnamayu. What it means he didn't want to drink them? He didn't say over in their name. So this is interesting here. The Gemara pivots a little bit and says that not that David refused to accept the psak, whatever the psak was, he had to accept. So then lo ava lishtotam doesn't make any sense, that he didn't want to drink them. So what the Gemara says is that it meant that he did not say over the halacha in the name of these individuals who risked their lives in order to get him the halacha cancer for the Sanhedrin. Why? Amar, kach mikublani beit dino shel Shmuel Ramati. This is the Mesorah I have from the Beit Din of Shmuel, kolom moser atzmo lamut al divrei Torah. Anybody who risks his life for Torah, ein omrim dvar halacha mishmo. We do not say over the halacha in his name. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean in any situation, in any circumstance. It depends if we're talking about Gzerat Hashmad. Depends on what the scenario or circumstance is. But anybody who risks their lives when it's not absolutely necessary and you're not found in a position of Gzerat Hashmad, then though we don't say over the halacha in their name because of the fact that they acted inappropriately. The Torah says, V'chai bahem, that you have to live by the precepts of the Torah, v'lo shiyamot bahem, and not that you die by them. And there's no command to be misakein nafsho, to risk one's life for finding out a halachic answer or a halachic question in these scenarios. We have the three cardinal sins, which you have to give up your life for. Other than that, the halacha does not override one's both right and necessity to stay alive. And that applies even by safek, even if it's a risk. There's still a requirement by safek pikuchach nefashot to be machmir and not give up one's life for Torah. The Maharal points out over here, even though the Gemara in other places says that ein divrei Torah mitkamim elam mish mei mitetzmo alam, divrei Torah are only kept or succeed in someone who gives his life for them. The way that the Maharal explains this in the Chiddushei Agadot does not mean literally that he gives up his life, but rather he's willing to sacrifice for divrei Torah. I mean, he's willing to sacrifice in his physical comforts and his physical life in order to succeed in Torah. Those sacrifices make it that divrei Torah mitkayimim bo. And that is what it's meant in the Gemara in Brachot that brings that memra. But not only that he gives up his life for it. Over here where the Gemara rejects such a concept of giving up one's life for a divrei Torah is because then the person is going to literally die in order to bring this Torah. Over there, it's counter to what the Torah wants. The Torah wants you to live by the Torah. It wants you to have a life, a chiyut and v'chai bahem. And so over here, there's a rejection of one putting themselves at risk. Then you cannot be someich al hanes, as Rashi says over here, in order to save you, just because you're doing it for divrei Torah. And so that is considered to be improper, and not the quote-unquote spirit of the Torah. And therefore, it says that we won't quote their name, or we reject such a approach. Other than may meet that small, that's where we're willing to accept, which is a person can sacrifice, give up things and items and lifestyle and comforts in order to succeed in Torah. That's acceptable for us because then that person is living the Torah and that person is alive. And so then in the figurative sense of Meimit Olea, it's allowed. But not in the real sense of Meimit Atzmalea, that's not allowed. And that's what's rejected by the Gemara over here. So then it says here, Vayasech Utam Hashem. He then gave them as a libation to Hashem. He dedicated to Hashem. Bishlaman Amandamar Hanei Tarte. According to the ones who say the latter two cases, Mishum D'Avad L'Shem Shamayim. What does it mean that he gave them up to Hashem? That he did it L'Shem Shamayim. Even though he was permitted to do it as a king, nevertheless, he took upon himself not to do it. So he dedicated himself L'Shem Shamayim not to act or exercise his right as a king and to act like a commoner. Elamanda Amar Tamun Ba'esh, Mai Vayasech Utam L'Hashem. According to the one who says with Tamun Ba'esh, what does it mean that he dedicated them to Hashem? He says, Damrino Mishma de Gemara. And he said it over in the name of the Gemara, meaning that he gave no attribution to the halacha. He said over the halacha, but he didn't do it with any attribution. He said it stam in the name of the Beit Midrash. So now there are a couple things to note here. First of all, even according to the one who says Tamun Beish, Gemara there concluded before that he has to then hold that there is Tamun Beish plus another question. But once you have plus another question, then we already could explain Vayasech Utam L'Hashem as referring to the other question. So the Baal Tosafot over here say that when the says Vayasech Utam L'Hashem Stam, it sounds like that refers to everything that was given or everything that was asked. And so therefore the Gemara still has a question with regards to Tamun Ba'esh. What does it mean Vayasech Utam L'Hashem? Over here, Tosafot notes that this part of the sugya seems to negate what Rashi said earlier. And he says, Mikan Kash the Perish HaKuntris. The Maseh Balef Anafshu Sarfu Anashav Gadish. that the case here was a case where they already had burnt something down, and they wanted to know what their liability is. That David did not want to drink. He didn't want to exempt himself just because he was a king. Meaning that, according to Rashi, the question already exists. Do I have to pay, or do I not have to pay? Once you have that question, you could explain the whole Gemara here without getting into this idea of he didn't want to quote them, he dedicated to Hashem. If the question is simply a halakhic question, meaning a priori, he's asking before his troops acted, what is the halakhic decision over here? Then all these questions exist. Because what does that mean, that he didn't want to accept it? What do you mean? Does he accept the halachic decision? What does it mean he doesn't accept it? What does it mean by sechutam Hashem? On the other hand, if they already had acted his troops and burnt it down, you can understand what it means that David was unwilling to accept, meaning he was unwilling to accept that he as the king was patur, and therefore he asked the question. He found out whether he should be chayav or not chayav, and whether he had to compensate or not. And that's what sechutam Hashem. So from here, the Balei Tosafot disagree with Rashi's explanation earlier, that it was an incident that already taken place, and he was asking a halachic question about the incident, but rather they see this as a question before the fact. Can they burn the item down? Can they do this for whatever strategic advantage they wanted to do it? Not so to save their lives, but are they allowed to burn it down? So this is an interesting question. First of all, in terms of the individual, we see in all these instances that the individual is never granted this right in order to use other people's property for his benefit. Even maybe for the point of Pikuach Nefesh, although it seems from at least the Balei Tosafot and many of the other poskim, that by real Pikuach Nefesh, that you would be able to do that, you just would have to compensate in that case. But what the Gemara does say is that when it comes to a king does have a right. Again, this is only if it's not for his personal benefit or his personal interest. That we already know is problematic because of what happens with Achav Izevel and the Kerem Navot, where he wants to confiscate the property. He can't just go and exercise eminent domain because he's the king and take away someone's private property. That's considered to be unacceptable. But when it comes to the king acting on behalf of the people, king is then granted a right to exercise eminent domain, whether that means to pave roads, or whether that means to set up his military, or to take advantage of a situation or strategic advantage by destroying the property of someone. All of those are permitted for the king because he's doing it on behalf of the population as a whole and on the behalf of the people as a whole. Well, the question is, does he have to pay or not? And here from this Gemara would sound like he did not have to compensate. The Rambam, on the other hand, says that the king has a right to exercise eminent domain, but when he does exercise eminent domain, he does have to give pitzuim. He does have to give compensation when he does that to pay back these individuals. It's an interesting question because it came up actually recently with the wars that Israel staged against Gaza. So when they staged the wars, they staged them out of the fields that are adjacent to the Gaza Strip. And so they set up the tanks and all the equipment. Everything is set up in the middle of these fields that belong to people. And they get run over and ruined and wrecked the fields. So technically, here, like the king, the government has a right to exercise eminent domain in a time of war, to go ahead and take the properties and utilize them for the benefit of the country as a whole. So then, in that case, technically, according to this Gemara, you may not have to compensate in that case, because melechata, you're acting as a king, in the sense of a king, meaning they're acting on behalf of the people as a whole, and therefore they have a right of confiscation. But, nevertheless, the Rambam does think you have to compensate, and the modern government of Israel as well compensates those farmers, or those individuals, whose fields are used for staging the battle. They do compensate them for that loss that is incurred. But it's exactly the question that's brought up over here, meaning the use of people's personal property for the benefit of the government in a situation of war. And again, situation of war, it's clear that you have a right. In other situations, it's less clear, although you might be able to exercise eminent domain, that difference might actually come up, meaning that in cases of war, maybe there's no necessity then to compensate. But in other cases where they need to build a road or they need to build a highway and you can't exercise eminent domain, maybe over there you can only do it with compensation because there it's not under the rubric of war where there's many more rights that are given to the king. The Mishnah now continues. And here the Mishnah, again, we're in the topic of Eish. So here the Mishnah is talking about Eish. You have to remember that we saw this in yesterday's daf as well, that Ki Teitzei Eish Umatza Kotzim. that the nature of the mazik of esh is that it was lit in the person's property, and then the esh spread, and it causes damage by spreading. The spreading happens independent of the individual lit the fire. The one who lit the fire is responsible for the ramifications or that which happens with the fire, but part of the mazik of esh is koach acher murav bo, that there's another force that's involved with here that's causing the spread of the fire. So part of the decision, the question that is here is, what is a safe way to light a fire? Or when are you not responsible? Meaning that you lit the fire in a way where you wouldn't have expected it to spread. Then if it does spread, it's outside of your realm of responsibility. So that's what this mission and the subsequent mission to deal with, which is, Avra geder shu gvoa dalet amot. If the fire was able to pass over a fence that was 4 amot high, o derech rabim, or an area that was a public thoroughfare, which we're going to see in the Gemara is 16 amot wide, onahar, or it traverses a river, patur. In all of those cases, you are patur, because the normal expectation is that a fire would not cross these barriers. And so if you lit a fire, your expectation would be that it could be contained by these barriers. If it is able to pass by these barriers, that's something that's unusual, unexpected. And therefore, it cuts off your liability, and you're no longer liable for that. Mar says, "Vatanya, don't we have a braita? Avra gader shugva arba amot. If it passes over a fence that is 4 amot high, chayav, you are responsible." Our Mishnah says that avra gader shugva dalet amot is patur. Now here you have a braita that says you are chayav. Seems to be a stira between the Mishnah and the braita. So now, there is a question about the Girsa Ot in the Mishnah and the Braita. The Tosafot spends a lot of time on what is the proper Girsa. One of the two proper Girsa Ot, they think, is what our Gemara has, which is that the word Ad does not appear not in the Braita nor in the Mishnah. And so that's, well, since it's the way that our Girsa follows, we don't really have to focus on it so much, but you'll see by the answer why it's important what the Girsa is. So Amar Papa, Tana Didan Kachoshiv Milamala Lemato, our Tana was counting from up higher numbers to lower numbers. Shesh amot patur. Chamesh amot patur. So when you start up at wall that's 6 amot high, patur. 5 amot high is patur. Ad arba amot patur. All the way down to 4 amot is patur. The way Rashi phrases it over here means ad v'ad bichlau. All the way down to 4 amot is patur. Tana bara, the outside Tana, I mean the Tana of the Braita, milamata lamalo. He is doing it from down, a smaller number, to a higher number. Kachoshiv, that's the way he's calculating. Shtei amot chayav, shlosh amot chayav, ad arba amot chayav. Until you reach 4 amot, you are chayav. And here Rashi says that the town of the Braita holds ad velo ad bichlal. Everybody agrees that 4 amot is patur. Just the question of how you are coming about it. Are you coming about it from higher numbers to lower numbers, or lower numbers to higher numbers? But the basic difference, according to Rashi, is that our Tana thinks it's ad the ad bichlau, meaning that dalet amot is patur, and he's speaking in that context. The Braita is speaking ad velo ad bichlau, meaning that until 4 amot is chayav, but 4 amot itself is patur. Basically, what it's saying, this is why the Girsa is so important, according to the Baya Tosafot, what it's basically saying is that our Mishnah is saying that arba amot is patur, period. And the Braita is saying ad arba amot is chayav, until 4 amot is chayav. So that's the problem if you don't have the Girsa. I mean, that there were Girsa Ot that had the word Ad in our Mishnah. And that would have made it much harder to explain it that way, or made it much more obvious that that was the issue. So that's why Tosafot favors a Girsa that is set up in a particular way. One of those options is when the word Ad does not appear in either of them, because that gives you a lot of flexibility in interpreting the Mishnah or the Braita and saying that one of them meant Ad, meaning Ad velo Ad bichlal, and one of them meant Ad v'ad bichlal, and that's why it's mentioning Arba Amot. So the way Rashi reads it, and the majority of the Rishonim read it, is that our Mishnah is Arba Amot Patur, that's Ad V'ad Bichlal, and the Braita is Ad V'lo Ad Bichlal, meaning that until 4 Amot is Chayav, but 4 Amot is Patur. There is a version in the Rabbeinu Yonatan that says just the opposite, which is that the Mishnah says, everybody agrees you're Chayav, and the Mishnah says Ad V'lo Ad Bichlal is Patur, and the Braita is saying Ad V'ad Bichlal is Chayav. And therefore, they just do it just the opposite of what Rashi says. But obviously, both of them are possible interpretations if you don't have the word Ad in either the Mishnah or the Braita. There is a third sheet of the Ra'ah, who suggests that nobody is speaking about Arba Amot at all. Arba Amot is just too miduyak. It's too precise. And all our Mishnah is saying is until 4 Amot you're patur. And the Bright is saying until 4 Amot you're chayav. But nobody's addressing Arba Amot itself. And therefore it's not a stira because they're both addressing approaching the Arba Amot. But nobody's talking about the Arba Amot itself. And therefore there's no stira between them. So now Amarava, Dalet Amot Shamru, the patur, afilu b'stei kutzim. That the Dalet Amot that you are patur for is even in a field full of brambles, thorns. I mean, that these are, as Rashi says, highly flammable materials. These are items that burn very quickly. So the wall or the fence that is Dalet Amot high works even in a field full of kutzim. That's one way to explain it. The Rabbeinu Hananel says that the chiddush here in kutzim is that the fire tends to spark or jump when it's burning up kutzim. And so you would think that it's more easily spread or it's able to overcome barriers. Nevertheless, Rava says this wall of Dalet Amot suffices even for a steak kutzim. Amra Papa, umisfat kutzim olamala Dalet Amot. It has to be from the top of the brambles 4 Amot high. Over here, the Balei HaTosafot make it clear that number one is if the wall is not higher than the fuel, that means the brambles here or the wood that is there, it's clear to everyone that you're going to be chayav. Because if the fuel sits above the level of the barrier, it's clear that the fire can clear the barrier. That's number one. Number two is it's clear here that the fence is not higher than the flames. Because if the fence was higher than the flames, there'd also be nothing to talk about because you should have assumed, or you could assume, that the fire will not pass the barrier. If it somehow gets past the barrier when the barrier is higher than the flames, that is extraordinary. So he says, that can't be the scenario here. The scenario here has to be a case where the wall is higher than the fuel, but not higher than the flame. And that's the scenario that Rapapa is suggesting over here. That the wall has to be 4 Amot above the kotzim, above the fuel, but still the flames are able to reach above that point. And nevertheless, you are patur because having it be that there's a spread of 4 Amot between the top of the fuel, I mean the flammable material, and the wall is enough of a barrier. Even though the flames are exceeding the barrier or higher than the barrier, it's still enough gapping or space that you would not assume that it could catch or cross that barrier. Amarav, lo shanu elo b'kolachat. That's one version here. You can see the Rambam has a different girsa of kodachat. Aval minichfefet, when it's nichfefet afilu ad mea ama chayav. Even up to 100 Amot, you are chayav. There was an alternate girsa here also ad mea mil chayav. Now, Rashi brings two versions of what the word kolachat means. The word kolachat, or the shorish of the word, can either be kelach, which is a stalk, or something that stands very tall, or it can be koleach. Koleach is used in other places in terms of pouring liquids. When water, the kiluach, is the stream of water or the stream of the liquid that pours out. And so based on that, Rashi brings two interpretations as to what the kolachat means over here. And by defining what kolachat is, you also know what nichfefet is. Nichfefet means to be bent over. Something that's kafuf, or bent over or low to the ground. So nichfefet is going to be the opposite or the antonym to whatever kolachat is. So if you define kolachat, you'll know what nichfefet is. And Rashi here brings in the first explanation, eishu koleach mitamer ve'ole lemala. It's something that burns directly upwards, straight up, like a kelach, like a stalk, something that goes straight up. But nichfefet is one where the wind bends the fire. Mean that the fire is moving to the sides. It's not just burning straight up. It's also focused or leaning towards the sides. And that's what makes it, I guess, more dangerous or more capable of crossing barriers is the fact that it's not an upward burning fire, but the wind is actually able to carry the flames, which is true that we know that whenever there's wind, the fire is more dangerous because the wind can cause the fire to jump and it can cross roads and it can overcome barriers. That's one explanation. Then he brings Lishna Achrina, Nechfefet Eish Nimucha, Holechev Nisrechet Basavim Uksamim Shagabe Akarka. He says that the other interpretation is that it's a fire that burns very low to the ground, and that it is what seemingly is a fast-moving fire that scorches or burns anything in sight, and therefore it's able to overcome barriers because of the nature of this fire, where it's not a fire that is burning in a strong or flowing manner, but rather a fire that is moving at high speed across the ground, and therefore it's able to also overcome barriers or cross over areas that you would otherwise have thought not. So that's what Rav is qualifying here, that the only time you have this exemption for these barriers is when you have a normal fire that burns upwards according to the first Lashon, or according to the second Lashon, a fire that is a normal fire that is streaming or flowing, but not, again, in the first Lashon, a fire that is moving from side to side or being blown by the wind, or according to the second Lashon, a fire that's fast moving across the ground. Because in those cases, afilat me'amah chayav, no matter how high the wall is or how distant you have here, it's not possible to protect against a fire like that moving or spreading. Shmuel amar, matnitan b'nichfefet. Our mission is talking about a case of nichfefet, when it's dangerous. Aval b'kolachat afilu koshu patur. By kolachat, even the smallest amount would be sufficient. And again, here, this is where Tosafot differentiates between the fuel and the fire. He says that afilu koshu can't mean that the fuel is above the level of the barrier. Of course, then, it would pass over or would cross over the barrier. But rather, a koshu means its smallest amount above the fuel, but it's still below the level of the flames. So Shmuel reads it that way. Tanya kavati de Rav. We have a braita that supports Rav's contention here. But med devarim omrim b'kolachat. Aval b'nichfefet ve'itzim mitzuyim la afilu ad me'a mil. Even up to 100 mil, chayav, he is chayav. So here is the alternate girsa of me'a mil versus me'a ma. As the Tosafot points out, when it says me'a ma before in Rav's statement, Me'amah is talking about the height of the fence. If you talk about me'amil, you have to be talking about the latter half of the Mishnah, or what the Gemara is about to speak about. And here, Tosafot says that the Gemara only brings it up over here, didn't bring it up earlier, and therefore he favors the girsa that says me'amah, that's referring to the fence. But over here, where it's referring to the other items, possibly, where you're crossing over other barriers, there maybe me'amil makes sense, because it says here, Avranar, Oshlulit, Sheim, Rechavim, Chetamot, Patur. If it passes over a river or a puddle of water that are 8 amot wide, you are patur in that case. So here you have a possibility of creating a barrier either through height, and that height would help you as long as you're talking about a fire that is a controlled type of fire. If it's a fast-moving fire, a fire that's jumping around, then those barriers will not help. Then the Gemara adds over here that if it passes over a river or a shlulit, over water, they only need 8 amot. Now that's in contrast to what the Mishnah seemingly said, that you need 16 amot for Derech Rabim. So why over here is 8 amot sufficient when before we said you need 16 amot? So the explanations are dual. One is that you have water. In the Shlulit, you have water there, and therefore the water adds or is an additional barrier to the distance. So when you have 16 amot, that's when you're talking about a dry Rishut Rabim or Derech Rabim. Then when you have a shlulit, 8 amot with water in it is sufficiently wide to stop the fire. Or the other possibility is depth, which is that a nahar, the bed of the river, is deep. It's not just that the river exists and has 8 amot, but you also have a certain amount of depth to the river. And that depth also helps with the stopping of the fire, as well as the fact that water flowing there. Or even if it's a nahar that does not have water in it, we're going to see in a second, maybe it'd be enough that the fact that water does sometimes flow there, that it has a cooler bed because of the water, and that would prevent the fire. There's moistness still in the ground around that area that would stop the fire from spreading. Those are all after the fact, which is that in order to put out the fire, the firemen light fires to take away fuel so the fire can't spread anymore. But here you're talking about what is the anticipated containment of the fire. There you're talking about prevention. Once the fire is already spreading, how do you stop it from spreading more? Well, here the question is, the person who lit a fire, how responsible is he for the spreading of the fire? And in that case, you can't expect the people to have to go burn down fuel to stop the fire from spreading. We want to know what are the natural borders or points where this fire would stop. And that's the question being asked. And again, that burning of fuel or clearing out places is not really an option. We want to know, when the guy lit the fire, what is sufficiently contained, or what can he assume will be contained? All right. Derech Rabim, Man Tano. Who is the author of our mission that says that Derech Rabim is enough? Amarava Rabbi Eliezer. It's Rabbi Eliezer. It's not, because the Mishnah says Rabbi Eliezer Omer Sheshesrei Amot K'Derech Rishut Rabim. It's 16 amot, like the Derech Reshut Rabim, which is the Mishnah upcoming. So that's not, that's what Rashi says over here, we're referring to the Mishnah upcoming. You see that there is an alternate girsa that says the Tanya, that it's a bright that Rabbi Elazar is speaking in. Rashi favors, and seemingly the Tosfot as well, favors that it's talking about the Mishnah or the upcoming Mishnah. And that the Gemara is saying is that this Mishnah is authored by Rabbi Eliezer. In a second, we're going to see another Mishnah that tells us that whatever is written in this Mishnah is a dat yachid. And that's the dat of Rabbi Eliezer. But there are others that argue on him. And that makes that into a stam v'achar kach machloket, which means that you have a stam Mishnah, and then afterwards you have a machloket. And the principle by stam v'achar kach machloket is the halacha is not like the stam Mishnah, but rather you have to look at the dinim or what is the rules with regarding the machloket. If it's the other way around, you have a machloket v'achar kach stam, then the stam Mishnah comes to tell you the halacha is like the stam Mishnah. But here it's the other way around, and that's what the nature of the Gemara here is saying, that the authorship or attribution of this Mishnah is Rabbi Eliezer. In a minute, you're going to see that there are other Tanaim that argue on him. O Nahar, Rav Amar Nahar Mamash. When we talk about a river, Rav says literally a river. Ushmul Amar Arita Didlai. We're talking about a irrigation ditch. Manda Amar Nahar Mamash Afa Gav Deleka Mayo. So this is what I mentioned before, that by a Nahar, and that's the word, the way that the word nachal is used in the Torah or throughout Tanakh. The word nachal does not necessarily mean a river. A nachal means equivalent of a river bed. It sometimes has water going through it, but it's an area that is in a valley between mountains and is sometimes a way that you could traverse the mountain range. Meaning that when Bnei Yisrael are traveling from the Midbar towards Eretz Yisrael, towards Arvot Moav, they have to cross through areas like Nachal Zared. They have to cross through certain Nachalim. Those are east-west Nachalim that are passable, or areas that can allow large numbers of people to pass through the mountain ranges, because most of the year they're dry riverbeds, and so you can walk through them. So also over here, the word Nahar or Nachal is being used not to refer necessarily to a flowing stream, but Nachal meaning that it's a valley or a ditch of sorts where you can, water does come, maybe either in the rainy season or during flash floods, but it's not a nachal which is continuously flowing water. And that goes back to what I mentioned before, why the nachal and nahar only has to be eight amot is because of the depth of it, the way that it's structured, that makes it that it's not just that the distance from bank to bank, but the depth or the moisture in the bed also helps you. Manda Mararita Didlai, the one who says it was an irrigation ditch, if it has water in it, then yes. But if it has no water in it, then it's not helpful. Because there, the Arita Delai, the whole reason that it's helpful is because there's water in it. It has nothing to do with the depth or the structure that it's there. It's simply the fact that it is water. So now, it's not Hotam. We have a Mishnah in Peah. And in Peah, we also have similar dinim, which determine for us, when you're taking Peah off of a field, what is the field? In that you have to leave the corner of the field as Peah. But you can only leave a corner of a field Peah if the field is one field. If you have multiple fields, you can't leave Peah from one field on the other field. Each field has to have Peah left for it. Because it has to be discernible or clear that this is the corner of the field that is going to be left over. So, in a case where you have fields that are contiguous, but there's some sort of natural barrier between them, or artificial barrier between them, are they deemed to be one field or two fields? So the question of division also comes up in the Mishnayot in Peah, and that's what we're talking about here. Ve'elu mafsikim the Peah. These are items or barriers that separate between fields and force you to take off separate Peah from each field. Hanachal, vashlulit, v'derech hayachid, v'derech rabim. So you have four items mentioned here, two of which we've mentioned before, the nachal, which is the river bed. Shlulit is a puddle of water, which the Gemara is going to ask in a second what exactly that is. B'derech yachid, b'derech rabim. Derech yachid is an area where yachidim walk, which seemingly is 4 amot wide. Derech rabim, which we mentioned before, is 16 amot wide. Obviously, if derech yachid splits, then derech rabim definitely splits. So there the Gemara talks about the fact that the seif of the Mishnah is a chiddush, that even there, a derech rabim doesn't help. So in the Reisha, the Derech Rabim is not meaningful, but in the Seif of that Mishnah for Ilanot, there Derech Rabim is a Chiddush, that there it doesn't separate. My Shlulit. What is this Shlulit that we're talking about? Again, in the modern Hebrew, Shlulit is a puddle. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Makom Shmei Gshamim Shololim Sham. It is a place where the rainwater gathers. That would be the simplest way to explain it. And the way Rashi brings it is Mitkabsim. They gather there. Kamo min hashlal shel beitzim. It's like a clutch of eggs. So there, use the word shalal to describe a clutch of eggs, which is a group of eggs that is brought together. Davar acher, lashon shalal umalkoach, parshat ha-shavua, davar ha-mikubatz. It's talking about the bounty or the beauty of the battle that is captured, that is brought together. They pile it all up, and then they divide it up. So that's the shalal. So again here, the shalal means to gather together or to aggregate. And so that's what a shlolit is. A shlolit is the gathering or the aggregation, the collection of the rainwater. The other possibility is, Rabbi Rabbi Yochanan, amat hamayim, shemechaleket shalal la'agafeha. It's talking about the irrigation channel, amat hamayim we've spoken about before. It's called an amat hamayim because it's an amat deep and an amah wide, but these are irrigation channels that are dug to bring water to the field. So here it brings and it distributes shlal, bounty, to its agafeha, to its banks. The way Rashi describes it is that they use the irrigation ditches to feed or water the fields. So the fields which are on its banks are beneficiaries of the bounty of the irrigation ditch. The way that Balei Tosafot read it is that when the water rises in the irrigation ditch, it overflows and fills up, whether it's the cisterns or the caves or the other receptacles that are near the irrigation ditch, that overflowing water goes and feeds them. So, manda mar makom shemeg shamim sholim sham, the one who says it's puddles of water, kol shekein amat mayim, certainly he would agree that amat mayim is a divider. Manda mar amat mayim, one who says an irrigation ditch is a divider, that is not considered to be a separator. Those are called the basins of the land, meaning that they are part of the natural topography of the land. They are not permanent, we'll call them irrigation ditches. They're things that fill up with water when it rains, and when there's no rain, they're not filled up. They're part of the natural contour of the land, and therefore you don't look at them as being dividers, but simply a part and parcel of the way that the land lays out. And so if that's the case, it would not be a separator or divider for the fields. Okay, here's the Mishnah that we just mentioned before, the Mishnah where it's achar kach machloket, where there is a machloket about what we seemingly thought was a given in the previous Mishnah, which is amadlik betoch shelo ad kama tavor adlika. Person who lights a fire within his own property, how far can he expect the fire to spread? You look at it as if in the middle of a field that is comprised of a beit kur. Remember, a kur is 30 sa'ah, so it's a large tract of land. And basically, you would say a half a kur in each direction. That's the standard distance that you would have to give. If you light a fire within your property, you could expect it to spread that much, but beyond that, it would not naturally spread. This is what the Gemara was quoting before, that the Stam Mishnah is like Rabbi Eliezer, that the Derech Reshut Rabim is enough to be Mafsik, because Derech Reshut Rabim over here is Tetzayin Amot, 16 Amot. And that, as Rashi notes in the previous Mishnah, is learned from the Agalot in the Midbar, how they were lined up next to each other, that defines the width of the Reshut Rabim. Rabbi Kiva Omer, 50 Amot. Rabbi Kiva says you need 50 Amot in each direction in order to consider it safe to light a fire and not expect it to spread. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Shalem Yishalem HaMavir Et HaBeira. You have to pay, you have to compensate for the fire that spreads. Hakol Lifi HaDleika. It all depends on the fire. As Rashi notes over here, and you'll notice that from the first question in the Gemara, that over here we think that everything is, you have to pay, according to Rabbi Shimon. Because it says, Shalem Yishalem. You're going to pay no matter what, no matter how big or small the fire is. And that's what it means. I'll call it the fe hadleka, meaning that you pay no matter what, irrespective of the size of the fire. And so that would mean Rabbi Shimon thinks you're liable in any situation. The Gemara will question that and then redefine Rabbi Shimon. It says, Gemara says, but lately the Rabbi Shimon shiura bitleka. He doesn't have any shiurim where it's safe to light a fire. He doesn't believe that a fire can be contained at all. V'hatanan, we have a Mishnah from Baba Batra. Lo ya'amid adam tonor b'toch ha'bayit. One is not allowed to put in an oven in their house. Elohim ken yesh agabo gvo adal ramot. Unless it has a clearance airspace above it of 4 amot. Hayam amido b'aliyah. Know that if he's putting it upstairs and not downstairs, ad shedei tachtav ma'aziva shlosha tefachim, until he has under him a thickness of plaster between the two floors, or below him it is 3 tefachim deep. V'kira, and if it's a kira, which is like an oven, it's like a stove top, that is tefach. You only need a tefach because it doesn't get as hot. Tanur gets super hot and has a very large fire in it. Therefore, you need more clearance on top and a bigger protection underneath it. The kira, which is like a stove top, has a smaller fire, is less hot, and therefore requires only a thickness of 1 tefach of plastering underneath it. And here it doesn't mention how much space above it. V'imizik, mishalei mashizik. Despite the fact that one took the proper precautions, if in the end something caught fire, he's still responsible for it. Rabbi Shimon, this is who we're speaking about in our Mishnah. Rabbi Shimon Omer, lo nemru shiurim halalu eloshim izik patur milishalem. The whole point of creating a code like this, a building code, is to say that if you follow the building code, you're not going to be chayav because you did what was proper to do. You set it up in a proper manner. Therefore, you have an exemption from liability if you did it properly. So here, again, Rashi says that the nature of the Mishnah is that the public at large can compel individuals to follow these precautions or to take these measures. In essence, there's a building code and they can enforce the building code because there's risk. If you don't follow the building code, it's not just a risk to you, it's a risk to the entire city or the entire neighborhood. Because if your house catches fire, then there's risk to all the proximate houses. Again, they're living in very dense situations that the fire will spread very easily and burn down the large part of the city. So we can compel people to keep the building code. The Baal Tosafot, while they agree with Rashi and think Rashi's right, they also note that it could be on a personal level, meaning that if you have people that live in a duplex, one's downstairs and one's upstairs, either the party upstairs or downstairs can compel the other party to put in the proper precautions so they're not endangered by the fire that's either burning downstairs or upstairs. So we see that Rabbi Shimon does believe that you can't contain, whether it's heat or fire, that you can't take proper precautions. So the Gemara says, okay, this is the way to understand Rabbi Shimon, which is, Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avuah, Kol Lifia Gova HaDleika. It all depends on the height of the fire. So the Gemara in the end doesn't give you the exact relationship, but what Rabbi Shimon says is something very logical, that it has to do with the intensity of the fire, the height of the fire, how far it can spread, or how far is considered to be sufficient distance that it won't catch fire, all has to do with the size of the fire. You can't make one assessment about all fires. Every fire is different, and every fire has to be assessed based on the height of its flames, as well as the intensity of the heat, and based on that, you'll know how much you have to separate, or you can expect the fire to spread. Amar Rav Yosef, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Halacha k'Rabbi Shimon, v'chein Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Shmuel, Halacha k'Rabbi Shimon. So over here they paskin like Rabbi Shimon. That goes back to what we said before, that the Stam Mishnah, even though it was Rabbi Eliezer, it's Stam v'achar kach machloket, which opens up the possibility that the Halacha is not like Rabbi Eliezer, even though he was found as the author of that Stam Mishnah, because it's the machloket, but afterwards. And here you see the Gemara paskining like Rabbi Shimon. Okay, the next Mishnah. Hamagbik et gadish ve'yubo kelim v'dalku. Person lights a gadish on fire, and there were items that were stored inside of it, and they burnt down, or they were consumed by the fire. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mishalei Mashi B'tocho. Rabbi Yehuda, the Shitato, who says, Yer Chayav V'tamun Be'esh, says you pay for everything. You pay for the grain or the tevah that was piled up there, as well as the items that were stored or hidden inside of it. Chamim Omer, Minu Mishalem, Ela Gadish Shel Chitim O Shel Seorim. He pays for the grain. Now he pays for it as if it's a full pile of grain. So even though there are items stored inside of it, and he doesn't have to compensate for those items, we still look at the space that those items took up as if they are either sorim or chitim based on the pile that's there, and he pays the equivalent value of that volume. Haya, and here we go, is the second half of the Mishnah. We've seen this twice before in the Masechta, which is Haya Gadi Kafut Lo. If the person lit a fire, and then it spread, and it burnt down the Gadish of his friend, and there was an animal that was tied there, and there was a servant, an Eved Kenani, who was proximate to it. Vinisrafimo, and then everything was burnt with this fire. Chayav, he is responsible, or he is responsible for the gdeed, which is tied up, because the gdeed had no way to escape, so he's chayav for the gdeed, he's also chayav for the gadish. He is patur for the eved, because the eved was not tied up. He's a thinking individual, and he has the capacity to run away. If he didn't run away, then it's his problem that he got burnt, because he didn't take the proper precautions, or he didn't make the right decision to run away. On the other hand, eved kafutlo, if the eved is tied up there, v'yadid samuchlo, and the animal is nearby, v'nisrafimo, and then he's burnt up, meaning that the eved is killed by the fire, because he was tied up, he had no way to escape. And similarly, the animal itself also was burnt up, even though the animal was not tied up. In that case, he is patur because of kamle derabamine. This individual is going to be subject to a death penalty because of the eved kani that dies. Because even an eved kani, if one kills an eved kani, they're still responsible in chayav mitah for that. So even though, again, first of all, he didn't do it intentionally, or even if it's only b'shokeg, we already saw under the b'shi law that also told us that even b'mitah b'shokegin, or even in the case where the actual execution is not carried out, you're still patur because of kamle derabamine. So in this case, because of the eved being killed, there's a kamle derabamine and you are patur. Now with regards to the animal, Rashi over here already brings both. We've seen this actually earlier in the Masechta, the Baal Yetzer Tosafot, and Rashi discussed this with regards to whether gdi kafutlo is essential to the case here. I mean, that the gdi being tied up, does that make it why you are chayav is because the animal was tied up? But had the animal not been tied up, you would not be chayav because the animal has the ability to run away. And the fact that it didn't choose to run away is the animal's problem and not your problem. Or do we say the fact that it mentions here gdi kafutlo and gdi sheino kafutlo, even in those cases, in either case, you're going to be chayav because we don't expect the animal to run away. The animal's not a human being that can make those proper decisions. And therefore, even if it had the ability to run away and it didn't run away, you're still chayav because it's mamon. It's the possessions of your friend, and you're responsible for them, just like the gadish, you're responsible for the animal that gets burnt up. The other possibility to explain here is what you can expect to be there. Meaning that a gdi, which is expected to be near a gadish, you're going to be responsible for. An eved that's not expected to be near a gadish, then you would not be responsible for him, because he should have run away. But the animal that is supposed to be there, or can be expected to be there, there you would be chayav. If a person lights a house on fire, then you're responsible for everything that's in it. Because it's normal for people to place things or to have things inside of a house. This no machlok between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim is only when he lit the fire in his own property, which is the nature of the pasuk. The pasuk says, ki teitzei eish u'matzah kotzim, which makes it sound like you lit it in your own property, and then it spread from your property into someone else's property. Then it goes out and spreads to your friend's property. Rabbi Yehuda mechayev aniske tamun be'eish rabbanan patre. That's where you have the machlok between. In that case, Rabbi Yehuda is mechayev and tamun, and the Chachamim are puter on tamun. This is where their machloket exists. If you light the fire in your friend's property, then you pay for everything, including the tamun. I mean that the Chachamim only see the exemption of puter of tamun when you light it in your own property, not when you light it in your friend's property. Now, the way the Rashi phrases that is because betoch shel chaveiro is considered chavei kema'abed biyadayim. It's as if you did it physically. It's as if you destroyed it physically when you light it in your friend's fire. In your friend's field, your friend's property, because you're doing it without permission. And then you're lighting directly. So if you think like Rabbi Yochanan, it's really easy to understand that it's Yishom Yishum Chitzav. And this sounds exactly like that. You're considered to be the one who caused the fire and spread the fire, and it's like Mazik B'Yadayim. If you say Yishom Yishum Yimono, you have to describe the scenario in the case where he lights in his friend's property, where again, he lit it directly. He's directly lighting the property or the gadish of his friend, because even there, Reish Lakish agrees that you are responsible because you were mazik b'yadayim. Amarli Rava, Ihochi, if you are right about this, then adatani seifa modim chachamim l'Rabbi Yehuda b'madlik et abira l'shalem kol mashu tocha shekein derech b'nei adam l'niach b'batim, that the chachamim agree to Rabbi Yehuda because a house normally contains items. Therefore, when you light on fire, you can expect there to be items inside, and you're responsible for them. You should give a finer distinction according to you, Rav Kahana, which is it's only true that you're patur and tamun b'esh when you light the fire in your own property, it spreads to your friend's property. You don't have to say about a bira, you can just talk about burning or lighting the fire in your friend's property. And so that would already be a distinction, even within lighting of a fire. Forget about a bira, it'd be the same thing with a gadish. A gadish in your own property is different than a gadish in someone else's property. So why are you going or describing a difference which is unnecessary? Here you're saying, oh, it's when you light a gadish in your property, or you light a house in your friend's property. Why should that matter? Lighting the house in the friend's property is not the only case where you're chayav for tamun, even a case where you light a gadish. You can have parallel cases between what's in your property and their property, and still come up with a distinction just because of the fact that it's your property versus their property. Therefore, Rav is unwilling to accept Rav Kahana's explanation. Here, the Balei Tosfot explain how to frame the Mishnah based on Rav Kahana, and therefore Tosfot believes over here that the Madlika de Bira was a case where you lit the Bira on someone else's property. It's not a case where you lit it in your own property and then it spread to your friend's property, rather a case where you lit it in your friend's property. So once you've done that, again, according to Rav Kahana, you don't have to go to a Bira to get the distinction you're looking for. You could simply talk about lighting in your property or their property. They're arguing about two items, meaning that there's a dual level machloket over here. That it's a case where if he lit it in his own property and then went and burnt stuff in his friend's property. Everything that is tamun there, you are chayav for. Your fire spread, you are responsible for everything that it consumed. That's whether it consumed things that are visible or things that are contained within. On the other hand, Rabbanan Sabri lo mechayev, period. You're not chayev at all for tamun ba'esh. In that case, you are completely patur. That is the gzerat ha-katuv of kama. Kama is something that's standing and visible, and that's the only thing you're chayev for. Upligi nami badlik shel chaveiro. And they also argue when you light the fire in your friend's property. Teribudu savar mishalem kol mashe b'tocho. Afilu anarchy. Once again, Rabbi Yehuda here believes that you're chayav for tamun beish. Not that by tok shalom it's any different. He believes you're chayav for tamun on all these instances, both in a case where you light in your own property, as well as when you light in your friend's property, you're chayav for tamun beish, no matter what is tamun inside. But the chachamim here differentiate. In the case where it's tok shalom, when it's your own property, you're patur from tamun completely. But in the case when you light in your friend's property, there, Rabbanan Savri Kilim, Shadarkan Atmin Begadish, things that are normally placed inside of a Gadish, meaning that your farm tools, or your harvesting, or your work tools, which is Gagon, Murigin, Uklei Bakar, like the threshing boards, and the Kilim, the utensils, or the tools that the oxen use in their work, all of those, you have to pay for, Hud Mishalim. That you have to pay for because that can be expected to be there. Kelim she'ein darkam latmin begadish, things that are not normally contained or saved or placed inside of the gadish, lo mishalem, there you don't pay for it. So that's the Balei Tosafot point out here. It's very interesting. They say that when it comes to your own field, there's a gzeret ha-katuv, which is kitetzei shematza kutzim, and the pasuk says, oh, kama. Kama tells you that only things that are visible you're chayav for, tamun be'esh, you're not chayav for. That is a blanket exemption for tamun be'esh because it's a gzeret ha-katuv. On the other hand, when it comes to lighting the fire in someone else's field, there you're not patur because it's not the pasuk in the Torah. Therefore, tamun ba'esh, the patur of tamun ba'esh is not applicable to you anymore because you're not the scenario that the Torah is talking about. So then why are you patur for any tamun ba'esh? Tosafot over here says, svarahi. It's just a logical argument that you're only going to be responsible for items that are normally found inside of the grain piles. That you will be responsible for, because that's normal, and that's something you can anticipate. On the other hand, items that you would not anticipate being there, you are not chayav for. And that's because it's all stemming from logic, not from a gzeret ha-katuv. Now that is, might be influenced by the sheet of the Rabbeinu Tam. The sheet of Rabbeinu Tam in the Sefer Yashar is that the whole Torah of Tamun revolves around this issue. And as opposed to the way we just explained it, that Tamun is a gzeret ha-katuv with regards to fire lit in your own field, Rabbeinu Tam always believes that it's a matter of anticipation. Tamun, or the chiyuv, or ptur of tamun, has to do with anticipation. What can you anticipate? What is considered to be normal? And therefore, the chachamim will say your ptur b'tamun b'esh is not because it's gzeret ha-katuv, but simply the Torah tells you that you're only chayav for things that you would have expected, meaning that things that, if you burnt it down, you would have expected it. And therefore, when you light it in your own property, and then it spreads where you're not a mazik b'yadayim, the Torah says you're only chayav for things that you can assume that when you lit the fire, you're going to be responsible for, or things that you could have anticipated that you are damaging. On the other hand, when you light on your friend's property, there you're mazik b'yadayim. So the exemption of tamun doesn't exist anymore because you're mazik b'yadayim. So based on that, the Rabbeinu Tam claims that the whole concept of tamun revolves around this ability to expect or not expect. But you see shades of that in the Balei HaTosafot who say, look, with regards to lighting the fire on your own property, that's gzeir ta'ketuv, you're patur from tamun no matter what. But when you light on your friend's property, already you have to know whether anticipation or not anticipated items. That's important because it's misvara. That's the logic that's associated with it. Tarabanan, amadika de gadish, vayulo kilim vidalku. Person lights a gadish, and there were items inside of it, kilim inside of it, and they were consumed or burnt. Yudo mer mishalem kol ma sheya betocho. Yudo says you got to pay for everything because he believes tamun be'esh is chayav. Chamim omim enu mishalem el gadish shel chitim or gadish shel se'orim. Chamim say you only pay for a pile of chitim or se'orim. Broim makom kilim kilu malei tvua. And you look at the place where the kilim are as if they were filled with tvua. This is what we mentioned in the Mishnah, that volumetrically you have to pay for the chitim or se'orim, whatever they would have taken up. So there's another item there that you couldn't have expected. Fine. As far as that item is concerned, you don't have to pay for its inherent value, but you still have to pay for as if the pile had wheat or se'orim in that place of that item that's there. But man, the very mamurim, where's that true? But madlik betoch shelo. When you light the fire in your own property, and then it went and burnt something in your friend's property. Of a madlik betoch shel chaviro, if you light in your friend's property, here there's a machloket. You can see Rashi has the girsa divrei akol, mishalei mashe betocho, you pay everything that is in it. And that you have to pay, even the chachamim seem to agree that mishalei kol masheya betocho. This would be problematic for Rova, meaning that this Braita is exactly like Rav Kahana's explanation of the Gemara against Rava. So you look at the first Rashi, he says, Rava metaritz le'detame. Rava is going to have to explain this Braita according to his own Shita, which is bekelim shedarkam latmin begadish. What it means is that divrei akol you have to pay is for things that are normally found in this place. And that's how Rava will explain it. And you can see the Balei HaTosafot do a similar thing. And even though, as the Balei HaTosafot pointed out before, that we were midaktek before, that when the Rabbanan argued on Rabbi Yehuda, he says, modim. Only when they say modim, do we say they completely agree with Rabbi Yehuda. But in cases where they don't say modim, we don't have to say that they agree completely with Rabbi Yehuda. So even though we explained the cases before, when we said that the Chamim agreed to Rabbi Yehuda, it means they fully agreed with Rabbi Yehuda. Over here, when it says that they all have the same opinion, since it doesn't use the word modim, it means that they have the same opinion with regards to kelim that are normally kept there. But not in general that they have the same opinion. Umode Rabbi Yehuda lechachamim. And Rabbi Yehuda agrees with the chachamim, mash'il makom lechaviro lagdish gadish. A person lends a space to his friend to put down his gadish. Vigdish. And he piled up his grains over there, vitmin. And he put stored things inside of it. Sh'enu mishalim. A person who owns that field and lent him the area, he does not have to pay for the items that were stuck inside or hidden inside. Ela d'mei gadish bilvad. He's only responsible to pay for the grain that was piled up there. Because he accepted responsibility, and when he granted you the right to place it there, he only granted you the right to put a gadish there. And that's all he's responsible for. Lagdish chitim, if he gave you the right to pile wheat, vigdish sorim, and instead you put barley. Seorim vigdish chitim, or if he gave you permission to put sorim and you put chitim, chitim v'chipan b'sorim, or if you put wheat there and you covered it over with sorim so you couldn't see what was underneath, sorim, or you had permission v'sorim v'chipan b'chitin, and then you cover them over with wheat, she'enu mishalem el demei sorim bilvad. In all those scenarios, the person is only responsible to pay for the demei sorim because of the fact that even though you gave you permission to put items here, in every case where he gave you permission for sorim, of course he's not responsible for more than sorim. But even in this scenario, we gave you permission to put in chitim there. If you instead put in sorim, or you put in chitim covered in sorim, then he can say to you, listen, yes, I gave you permission for chitim, but in the end, all I saw there was sorim. So when I had to make a decision whether to stop the fire or to hire people to stop the fire, I said, it was sorim, I'll pay for the sorim. It's not a big deal. Had I known it was chitim, maybe I wouldn't have made that decision. But because all that was visible to me is the sorim, that's only responsibility he has is what is visible there. So unless he's notified of the fact that there are chitim inside of the sorim, he can assume whatever he sees there is in the entirety of the pile or in the entirety of the contents of the pile. Tosafot over here says that it's clear that the scenario or the case here is a case where he's madlik betoch shelo, because the upcoming cases will show us that if he lo betoch chaviro, that if he did give him permission with sorim and he ended up putting chitim, Why would he not be responsible if he can see that there are chitim there and he's going down and burning or lighting a fire without permission his friend's property? So in that case, in each of those instances, it's a motzi mechaveru lav araya, and so the individual who lent the field pays the least amount, which is the silrim in all of those scenarios, because we assume he didn't accept any more responsibility than that which either he gave permission for or that which he can't see. In either of those scenarios, that is a limit to his liability in those cases. All right, we're going to stop here, 10 lines down on the top of Samach Bet Amud Aleph.